Policy Monday seminar. So today we're taking advantage of Ashley Guard for nature to give a kind of talk. She's speaking again tomorrow, so don't do the talk with tomorrow. Ashley is a scholar who studied at Brown and Harvard for going to postdocs against the president and now in Professor Santa Cruz. Julie Kelly is about internal inflation, multiple universes, and other dark matter.
Thanks. Do I need to use this microphone?
You need to be recorded, yeah. If I'd like to record you.
Be careful with this.
Well, we just found out that it tracks you not very fast, so you can run out of the screen and say something.
So if I make really controversial statements, I'll run across the room and cover my head. Some sort of
the non-off switch, maybe?
I got the non-off switch. It's giving me after the clouds.
There might be something on the screen
or anything.
We can all hear you here anyway.
So, put together this talk, which I hope will at least be entertaining, about some things that I've been thinking about in terms of early universe cosmology and these strange issues about internal inflation, multiple universes, and other things. So as you all probably know, Big Bang was not entirely satisfactory model in the sense that the initial conditions seemed very funny to us. There was this homogeneity on scales that couldn't possibly have been causally connected. There were sort of unnatural degree of flatness in the initial conditions such that when we got to this stage in cosmology, we would be more or less flat. There were initial density fluctuations that had to come from some source. A particular amplitude, particular form, and also be acausally connected, which had to be stuck into the initial condition. And there were effects from very early times in the Gun era, like monopoles, that should overflow the universe if they weren't taken care of something. And inflation is now widely accepted as a curative problem. The idea being that you start out with a sort of quasi-flat, quasi-homogeneous, sort of Friedman Robertson walk universe. Inflation comes along and fixes everything, so you have a nice, flat, homogeneous, separate universe with the density fluctuations you want. But there are two sort of problems with this picture. One is that you still need initial conditions for inflation. You still need to say why you have this thing with the amplitude field at a particular value pi up on its potential that it has to start at, and quasi-homogeneous and universe quasi-flat. And the other sort of annoying thing about inflation at some level is that it never ends. This simple picture just isn't really what inflation actually looks like. And this has been known for quite a while, and it is caused in a lot of different inflation models, but in the sort of most simple inflation model, like a phi squared or a phi to the fourth model, it happens because the amplitude field does tend to roll down to the bottom of the potential. But if you account for quantum fluctuations, it can sometimes roll up and sometimes roll down while overall steadily rolling down. The problem is that the exponential expansion of inflation means that although lots of regions will roll down, the regions that don't roll down or even roll up a little bit exponentially expand, so that if you look at the total amounts of volume at, say, this field value as a function of time, although lots of the volume goes to lower field values, the volume that's at that field value expands exponentially, and the total volume of that field value increases with time overall. So the fraction of the field sitting up here will go down, but the volume of the field sitting here will always increase. And so inflation never actually comes to an end overall, regardless of regions that are inflated. Only every once in a while does some region make it all the way down repeat and provide some recent characteristics described with radiation-dominated Big Bang model lightning, right? And it's actually a little bit tricky to do what I just said more precisely for various reasons that I'll come back to a little bit. But there's one example you can do pretty carefully, and that's when you have a double well detection, so a false vacuum and a true vacuum. And you can have tunneling events where the field tunnels through this potential barrier and creates a bubble of the true vacuum. After the tunneling, the field can roll down here and have slow roll inflation before it gets to the bottom. And you can show pretty clearly that although a lot of the volume will transition to this true vacuum bubble, the inflated background that you started out of that false vacuum level will keep on going. And the way you can see that is to say that these bubbles of true vacuum basically expand with the speed of light. So if there's a bubble in your past light cone, you'll be in the true vacuum because one of these bubbles will overtake you. If the bubble forms in your past light cone, then necessarily you'll be in its future light cone and therefore you'll be inside it. So you just have to count up how many bubbles will be in the past light cone at a typical point. So you can find the fraction that should be inflating by looking at e to the minus the nucleation rate, that's a rate per unit pore volume that we call this format, times the total pore volume in the past light cone over a randomly chosen point. And that's this number and this number. So that's the fraction that's still inflating at any given time. If you then take the volume that's inflating at any given time, it's that fraction times the expansion factor given the 3HT, gives you the volume. And that gives you this number that if the nucleation rate is small here, is a positive number, so that the total volume that's inflating exponentially grows over time, as long as the nucleation rate is small. And I think this calculation is just clear, that in that case, internal inflation occurs. And I think it also tells you something a little bit more general in the sense that these bubbles expand at the speed of light. So it seems hard to see if you have some big region that's inflating and some kind of causal process that happens. In other words, causally disconnected regions can't synchronize themselves to do this thing at the same time. But the best you're going to do is kill off inflation in a way that depends on some random process and grows at the speed of light. And that won't do it unless the nucleation rate is quite high. So I think, in general, it's going to be very, once you get inflation started, it's very hard to kill off. So the next picture of sort of messy universe, inflation, really nice universe, has now been replaced in a lot of inflationary cosmologists' mind by a picture where you have messy universe inflation forever. And every once in a while, you get some region that's like a flat homogeneous FRW Big Bang that can describe the universe we're in. And this occurs to some sort of quasi-steady-state distribution of inflation and thermalized regions that would be sort of the universe as a whole. And all these little things would be like little Big Bangs. So if all of these little regions are different universes, they're different regions that are bigger than our observable universe, but more or less Big Bang models, then this is what people have thought about for a long time and call the multiverse. It's lots of little universe-like regions that, in principle, can have different properties. And this has gotten a lot more interest recently because of string theory, which, as I'm sure you're all aware, has recently forgotten a lot about the possibility that low-energy physics can be given by some particular minimum in this landscape potential that governs the moduli that come into the low-energy physics coupling constants. So if those moduli vary across these different bubbles, the low-energy physics in each one can be different, and the cosmological parameters can be different. A sort of older idea is that in quantum cosmology, even if you just have one universe, not this eternal inflation set, even if you just have one universe, it would be described by a wave functional. And different branches of that could have different cosmic properties, these sort of different coexisting universes. So if you have some idea that a fundamental theory of cosmology, the real theory of cosmology, was something like string theory with inflation and was quantum cosmology, then it's a little disconcerting that all three of those components have this property that There isn't just one thing. There are lots of different things, lots of different regions or models or branches of the wave function that can describe our universe. And this gets a little tricky, because we'd like to have predictions of our fundamental theory of cosmology compared to our observations. So what I'd like to talk about a bit is, what do we do in that situation? We had some fundamental theory of cosmology that predicted lots of different universes with different properties. How could we possibly compare that with the things that we see? So I would assume that we have, in this sort of mental exercise, we have some actual ensemble of sub-universes with parameters that characterize the physics or the sort of big bang initial conditions in each sub-universe. And that's some probability distribution that governs those parameters. And I like to specify that in terms of the probability that a randomly chosen baryon or a randomly chosen longing element resides in a sub-universe characterized by some particular set of those values. And you'll see a little bit more why you have to be careful about how to specify these probabilities too. And then we need some way to connect these probabilities, if we compute them, to what we observe. And I'll talk about three sort of thorny issues that come up when you try to do this. One is there some unique prescription to connect these probabilities to what we observe, or do we have to make some sort of choice on some basis of how we do that? Second, what role is played by oft referred to but carefully not mentioned anthropic principles? And third, in a term inflation, do these probabilities even make sense? Can we actually invoke a computer principle? So issue one was, is there a unique way to connect probabilities to what we observe? I think the answer to that is just no, there isn't. And you can get a sort of feeling for that by considering, well, let's just naively say, let's count up all universes that have some property and compare it to the number of universes with another property. So let's say universes could be blue or red, and we want to see what's the probability that we live in a blue versus a red universe. So our theory might tell us that there are four times as many blue universes as red universes. But what if, does it matter that the red universe is much bigger? I mean, couldn't we just consider that red universe to be four separate red universes? This universe is much bigger than our cosmological horizon, so why not just consider it four independent universes? In which case, these would have the same probability. Or what if the universes have the same volume, but one of them has nothing in it? It has no baryons or matter or anything, it's just sort of infoton. Do we really want to count that universe as just as important as all the universes that have baryons and volume and matter and structure and people in them? And which way we choose to do this will give different answers. That's all. And another piece of evidence that there's the answer to this question is no, is that people have simply done it in different ways when they've actually tried to think about things like this. So I've sort of cataloged these as three different ways that people in the literature have talked about this. One, and I realized that I found through talking to people that this terminology is counterintuitive to particle physicists, but just bear with me. One that I'll call the bottom-up approach is to start with our theory, our fundamental theory. That's the way I think of this, is that's at the bottom. And then all the predictions percolate up to that. And we compare our universe to just the most typical in the ensemble. We just say, what's the most common universe, or what's the most common region with a specified volume, or what's the most common environment for a baryon, or something like that. And this is kind of nice in the sense that we don't have to make any extra assumptions about what we're looking for. But it's not nice in the sense that we do have to make this decision about whether we want to weight by universe, or by volume, or by baryon, or something like that. We have to make that decision still. Another choice is the top-down approach, which is to say, well, we don't really care about all kinds of other universes that are totally different from ours. What we really want to do in physics is say, given everything that we know, what are we going to see if we do some future experiment? That's the way lots of laboratory experiments work. We set up the experiment. We say, what is my physics theory telling me in that experiment what will happen? We do the experiment and see if that happens. So that's the idea of the top-down approach, is we compare our universe to and see what is the most typical universe matching everything that we've already observed. So we narrow our selection process to universes that are just like ours in terms of everything we've seen already. And this is also a little bit strange in the sense that it leads us to set theories for which the observed cosmological parameters are wildly improbable. So if a theory that gives our cosmological parameters is totally atypical, it's like incredibly rare, we nevertheless accept it and just say, well, that's the kind of universe we're in. So it's a little bit strange in the sense that we accept today what if we make a prediction, if we measure something, we accept a theory today that has that property. Yet if we had predicted 2 days ago, then we would have ruled out the theory. So it's a kind of strange way to do physics. I personally don't care for it much, but I mean, keep it into consideration. The third approach is the anthropic approach, which is to say, well, we're talking about observed cosmological parameters or physics parameters, so let's compare the most typical observed universe. And the question here, of course, is what is an observer? And you might hope that somehow magically making this decision about how we compare our probabilities to the observed universe wouldn't matter, but somehow they would all give the same results. And I think this is just not going to happen. I think sort of all of these three different ways, and then there are sort of sub-different ways within the three, all are going to give not just different predictions and details, but different sort of qualitative predictions. And they give you a feeling for how that would happen. Now, the predictions can be sort of qualitative predictors, even for things that we haven't measured yet. There's one sort of interesting example, which is, let's suppose that we know that there's dark matter, almost certainly. But we don't know what the dark matter is, we have no idea. But we always assume that it's basically one substance. There's light supersymmetric particles, or there's axions or something. But of course, in principle, there could be different kinds of dark matter. There could be light supersymmetric particles and axions, and some combination of all the different dark matter particles that people have dreamed up over the years. All of these are things that at least somewhat physically make sense, or else reputable people wouldn't be written about them. So in principle, a lot of them could coexist in our universe. We generally don't think that they do because it would be weird, because I'll explain in a minute. But let's assume that in our multiverse, which has all kinds of fields and all kinds of physics living in it, that there are lots of different dark matter components governed by independent physics. And that's not a realistic assumption, but one which will sort of make more poignant the contrast that I want to draw. And that each one is governed by a probability distribution, meaning that if I just pick some universe, it'll have some amount of axions and Susie particles and so on. And the probability for getting some set of densities of those will be given by some probability distribution that I calculated for each individual dark matter that's specified in terms of the omega dark matter divided by omega barium. So this is the dark matter barium ratio. So I have some probability distributions that tell me what is the probability distribution for getting x and y and z amounts of each of these dark matter components in each galaxy. So that's the stuff. Now the funny thing is, from the bottom-up standpoint, it would be strange for any of these two dark matter components to have a very similar density. For the normal reason, that you think of, which is that if they're really independent physics, it would just be sort of strange coincidence or fine-tuning if I wanted them to have the same density. This is the whole reason that people think it's weird that dark matter and the baryons and the cosmological constant all have more or less the same density today. Because why should they? Why would there be no coincidence? Similarly, it would be very strange if we had, from the normal standpoint, that we had baryons and Susie particles and axions and Lipzillas all with the same density. I think most people would agree that that's strange. Nevertheless, that would be quite natural in the anthropic or the top-down approach to comparing probabilities to our observations. It would be very natural to have multiple components with the same density. And this is counterintuitive enough that it's worth going through a little bit of detail. So let's look at the top-down approach. So the idea is we condition on all the data that we know and predict what we don't know. So in particular, we limit ourselves to universes that have a total dark matter to baryon ratio that's the one we observe. It's about 6. But we say that we don't know what that dark matter density is made up of. It could be made up of any combination of these different possible dark matter candidates. So let's see what's most probable. We want to ask, given that condition, what is the most probable universe that we have to live in? So let's look at some individual components. If the probability distribution for one of the dark matter components peaks at values of very low density, then it's most probable that in our universe, that dark matter component would take a really low density. So if axions tended to have a neg of 10^-5, probabilistically, it would be reasonable for us to be in a universe like that, because there's no conflict between that and our conditionalization, which is that the total dark matter is 6, as long as there's some other kind of dark matter to make up for it. So to start those, so the rest should be peaked either at or above our measured amount of dark matter. So we want to maximize the product of those probability functions. Remember, they're independent, so the total probability is just the product, subject to the condition that the betas, these dark matter ratios, add up to 6. And then an interesting thing happens. So for example, suppose that each one is a power law. And that'll be approximately true over some narrow range for any of these things. Then what you actually find is that the maximum occurs when each of these individual dark matter ratios is basically the same, only different by the index of the power law that the probability distribution has. So if I have, you know, axions go, the probability distribution of axions increases with axion density to the square, and Susie particles go to Susie density to the fourth, then my predicted rough ratio of Susie to the axions will be 2 to 1. So there will be a comparable density unless these power law indices are orders of magnitude different. So, of course, there are lots of ways out of this. Power law indices won't necessarily be, you know, there could be Gaussian probability distributions with huge power law indices, et cetera. The point is not that. The point is that you can quite easily make a sort of natural, comfortable model where you don't tune anything, where these dark matter densities come out to be roughly the same order of magnitude, even though the physics is totally independent. The physics is only tied together by the fact that they have to add up to this particular number, which is the one that we observed. And that conditionalization forces them to all be the same ballpark. More or less the same thing happens in the anthropic approach. And I wanted to talk sort of in more detail about the anthropic approach. So, and this is really my second issue that I wanted to talk about. So what's the point of these anthropic arguments? So the way that people generally have, the reason people have made anthropic arguments is to provide some explanation, which otherwise would be lacking, for the particular set of parameters that we observe relative to some wide range of values it seems that they could have had. Say if we had a multiverse, or just if, you know, God was creating the universe and had to throw us a dice first, why would there be this particular set of values that we have other than some other ones? Or if we propose to reconcile the values that we've observed with the very different values that would be expected on some fundamental practice, as in the cosmological constant problem, the anthropic argument is devoted to explain why ours is so tiny compared to the natural scale of the cosmological constant. And it's also been invoked to explain why the observed parameters of values appear so nicely fine-tuned for life, in the sense that it's been argued that if we change these significantly, then life as we know would not exist. And the way that the most respectable anthropic arguments work is that they say, let's calculate the probability that a particular set of values of the parameters will be observed, accounting for the fact that only certain values allow observers in the first place. And if this probability is concentrated near values that we observe, then we can claim that we've explained the observed values, in the sense that our values are typical among all observed values by all observers that exist in this big ensemble of regions that might or might not have observers. And there are, I think, five more or less essential ingredients of an anthropic argument like this. First, you need a multiverse, of course, a real multiverse where all the individual pieces exist. You need some probability distribution over that multiverse. You need some definition of what constitutes an observer capable of measuring the values of the parameters in the subuniverse. And this gets really tricky, because, of course, we're familiar with observers like this, but we should take into account observers like this, too. Maybe silicon orbiting a black hole, and they require very different conditions for its existence than we do. And we just simply have no idea what sorts of observers we should be considering. So that makes it very hard. We also need some computation of, if we pick these observers, how many observers there are in a universe with some set of parameters. And even if you choose observers to be Homo sapiens, it's not clear how we count them. You know, should we count galaxies? Should we count stars? Should we count stars around the solar mass, planets around a solar mass star with same density in a galaxy like ours? With the universe age like ours? It's not really clear at all what the link between our existence and our astrophysical environment really is. And finally, we need the assumption that we have a universe with parameter values that are typical, parameter values that are at or near the values that will be observed by a typical randomly chosen observer. And Boankin has called this the principle of mediocrity. And I think this is a reasonable assumption to make, but we have to keep in mind that improbable things do happen all the time. For example, this couple won $500,000, even the odds were like 1 in 800,000. So they couldn't have done it, it was highly improbable, and yet it happened. So somebody has to be lucky or unlucky.
Why is that last one important? I don't really see why that.
Oh, because if we don't have this, and all we've done is calculate what a typical observer would see, but we haven't said that that's what we'll see. So we need this assumption to say that we're going to see what a typical observer sees. That we didn't get, we're not on the real tails of the probability distribution.
So how we're having to live on those tails, provided that.
That's already been taken into account. So this is the typical observer. So we've already taken into account the observers maybe on the tails of the fundamental problem. But we're saying once we calculated the probability distribution requiring observers that were typical in that.
Then you have to assume that an observer in one of them has to see that's going on in another one.
I don't think there's any assumption that that's possible for
maybe possible just from that from the universe.
Yeah, I think we're all certainly not.
So what does it mean for
the universe? You only observe your universe. So that's the whole tricky part of this. We have lots of universes with different predictions. We have a prediction of a different universes with different properties. And we only get to make one observation. We get to observe ours. And we have to infer as much as we can about this fundamental theory, if such exists, on the basis of that one set of observations. And that makes it really different from physics as we do it now. Because physics as we do it now, we say, I'll do an experiment, and it'll rule out some theory at 95% significance. And if that's not good enough, we can do more experiments and rule it out at 99.9% significance, as much as we like. Here, we have a theory, we rule it out at 95% significance, then we're done. You know, that's as good as it'll get, unless we can find new cosmological parameters to measure. We can't repeat the same experiment and get better data. So that's where I think the essential difference is. So we have these ingredients, the fundamental probability distribution, which I've drawn here is a two-dimensional one, the two sort of made up parameters. We then multiply it by our anthropic factor, that's the thing that tells us how many observers there are, it's a function of those two parameters. And then we get this anthropically conditioned probability distribution that we're assuming that we're in the middle of instead of out on one of the tails of this distribution. So I made a particular form of the anthropic factor there, this kind of two-dimensional delta function, but it's worth asking what forms could the anthropic factor take. Well, one would be a delta function. That's the sort of classic idea of the anthropic principle, which is basically one set of parameters that would allow reasonable structure, living beings and stuff, And that's where we have to live. And there are lots of different universes, but only that particular kind of universe allows beings, and hence we're necessarily in it. And that would be nice for that classified view of the anthropic factor. It would be a disaster for fundamental cosmology, because if the anthropic factor really were a delta function, then it would take away all the information about the probability distribution that came out of our fundamental cosmological. All that would go away because we're multiplying this complicated function that has all kinds of interesting physics in it by a delta function that has to do with this, our existence and life and some assumption about observers and so on. I think that would be sort of bad. Fortunately, I'll say, I think that's not the case. Another possibility, one more level of complexity, would be a theta function. Something that would just enforce a minimum or maximum value on some cosmological parameter. And that's what happens, for example, in the cosmological constant anthropic argument, where you say that if the cosmological constant were too high, then basically we shut off structure formation before any actual galaxy. So that gives an upper limit on cosmological constant. And if you use that to consider, you use that as an anthropic factor to calculate the maximum probability subject to this, you find that it's most likely to have a small but non-zero cosmological constant. And there's a similar argument for small non-zero neutrino ones. The problem with this argument is that what's a theta function in one dimension may not necessarily be a theta function in two dimensions. So if we let other parameters like cosmological constant and the neutrino mass, or cosmological constant and the density of primordial perturbations or some other constants vary at the same time, bad things can happen to this sort of argument. So that brings us to the third possibility, which are degeneracies in the anthropic factor, meaning that the anthropic factor might be large along some line or in some whole region of parameter space. And these, I think, are more or less inevitable. For example, if you recall the issue that I was talking about, different possible dark matter components adding together to be the dark matter that we see, basically, as far as we know, only the total dark matter to baryon ratio is really important for our existence. We need it to form galaxies, given that all the other parameters are what they are. But we don't really care whether it's axions or Susie particles. If there was some way we could care, that would be an easy way to measure whether it was axions or Susie particles, and we wouldn't be worrying about what the dark matter is. The very fact that it's so hard to figure out points to the fact that only its gravitational effects, its existence, are important for anything that we've measured so far, for example, existence. So, as for the top-down approach, we can maximize the total probability for these dark matter components subject to some constraint on the total dark matter ratio, which again, if the anthropic factor forced the dark matter baryon ratio to be more or less the value that we see, then the anthropic approach would also predict multiple components of dark matter of a comparable density. Maybe not predict, but make natural, let's say, rather than being unnatural as it would be without. And that same argument, more or less, can be applied to dark energy or density perturbations. In other words, the density perturbations could be, at some level, cosmic strings and inflation. Density perturbations are a little tough, because inflation tends to kill off all the other ones. But for dark energy, there could be 10 different scalar fields that are contributing to the dark energy we see. And at some level, this would be sort of awful, that the anthropic principle devised to explain coincidences that we've already seen, like the dark matter to baryon ratio, that's part of, I didn't mention that in my list, but that is another reason people thought about the anthropic approach to explain these coincidences. Predicts that there ought to be even more coincidences to uncover in the future. And the preposterous universe, as it's been called, is going to get even worse. On the other hand, you might think that's nice, that the anthropic principle sort of, as a methodology, makes this general prediction that we ought to uncover the more strange coincidences that seem unnatural from a sort of fundamental physics standpoint. As I mentioned, these degeneracies can also sort of undermine anthropic arguments that they make. For example, this anthropic argument that the cosmological constant has to be small because it truncates our structure formation and some density. But on the other hand, if you raise the perturbation amplitude, it speeds up structure formation. So this is sort of complementary. You can have a higher cosmological constant, you also have a higher primordial perturbation amplitude. Or high primordial perturbation amplitude makes halos denser, and you might have a lot of stellar collisions, which you might imagine in the afterlife. But if you lower the baryon density, you can compensate. So there seem to be sort of playoffs between the cosmological parameters that allow you to have not just one unique value, but lots of different values that might be compatible with life. And I spent a little while thinking about how bad is this problem. And I thought about the six basic cosmological parameters: primordial perturbations, the photon-to-baryon ratio, the dark matter-to-baryon ratio, the lepton-to-baryon ratio, curvature scale, and cosmological constant, and asked, can any or all of these be very different without presenting observers like us? And by observers like us, what I took in doing this exercise was to think about solar mass stars that were long-lived and had solar mass, so that's what I call an observer. Of course, it's not, but one might argue that it's at least necessary for observers. And we can look at hot Big Bang-like cosmologies while twiddling around the cosmological parameters and see what happens. It's in the sense of preventing such solar mass, long-lived, solar mass metallicity stars from existing. And Hedmark and Reese did a little bit of work on this, and they said they found that for sufficient cooling, you needed Q above some value. To avoid stellar collisions, you need Q below some value. To avoid cosmological constant dominating, you need lambda below some value. But these all depended on some of the other values. So you can see right away these degeneracies happening, for example, between the density of perturbations and the photon-baryon ratio, or the cosmological constant, the photon-baryon ratio, and the density of perturbations. And not content with sort of factoring a few differences in these cosmological parameters, I decided to go far out and think about a totally different cosmology with all the cosmological parameters very different from the ones we observed, and see whether that was fine. So I considered cold cosmology, where the photon-to-baryon ratio, instead of being 10 to the 9, was about 1. What happens then is that in nucleosynthesis, you can actually get heavy elements. So you can get carbon and silicon and nitrogen and things that we want for life like us in primordial nucleosynthesis, which doesn't happen in a normal Big Bang model. You can also get structure formation that happens incredibly early, because the gene's mass is just given by basically when structure starts forming, the lepton-to-baryon ratio and the photon-to-baryon ratio like this. So for those low values, this is in solar masses, you can get tiny, tiny structures forming very early. And you can make, it turns out, sort of two scenarios like this. One being where you get very big first stars, about 10 to 5 solar masses. You heat up the universe and form galaxies later on with the remnants of those stars as dark matter. And this, I can see no particular reason why this wasn't as likely to form observers of our universe, even though it has no dark matter primordially. Just has the dark matter from these remnants, but it has a tiny value of the primordial perturbations, because structure forms so early, you're allowed to start out with a tiny value of this. An even more outlandish theory is where the first stars that form actually start to flash about 100 years after the Big Bang in super dense clusters, and then hierarchically form further structures, and you can get even smaller values. This is Q of 10 to the minus 11, so that's 6 orders of magnitude smaller than the one you see, up to 10 to the minus 8. And a dark matter-to-baryon ratio of 0 to a few. And what this allows you to do, if you think about it, is that cosmological constant is allowed to dominate structure formation at 200 years, because all the structures we need in solar mass stars and little clusters have already formed. So it turns out you can actually have a huge cosmological constant, and that's enough. So if you think about, for example, Q, and that's the density of perturbations and the photon-to-baryon ratio, the anthropic hope, sort of, was that this would be more or less a delta function. But in fact, near the hot Big Bang, this degeneracy that Tegmark and Reese pointed out allows lots of regions. And the cold Big Bang allows super different values, at the cosmological constant of 17 orders of magnitude larger than the one we observed in that cold Big Bang. So the bottom line, I think, is that unless we try to put more ingredients or require more things for observers to exist, that there are going to be huge degeneracies in this anthropic path. In other words, there's certainly not going to be some particular unique set of cosmological parameters that gives a universe that's hospitable to life unless we put in lots more information than, say, solar map stars or solar systems. So now I'll move on to issue three. Let's say we know the crystal theory, and let's say we even knew how to calculate this anthropic factor. Could we actually compute this probability distribution? And this leads to some very puzzling sort of thorny issues, which Ruth is delighted in bringing up in a series of few papers. For example, if you ask, what is the cosmic time since the Big Bang? So we have this, you know, initial Big Bang, this real cosmological singularity. Inflation springs out of it. We have all these bubbles forming at all different times after that. And for each bubble, we could ask, what's the time since the Big Bang? And for any observer, basically any way you cut it, that time is going to be infinite. But if we try to calculate the typical time, or like the average time for an average observer, or just an average universe, we don't have to bring observers into this, then that's going to be some integral over the number of universes at a given time, times the time, and that's going to be infinite. So any observer has a finite value, but the typical observer will have an infinite value. So all observers are sort of infinitely atypical. It's a little strange. Another sort of even more perverse consequence is, if you ask what's the average age since reheating of an observer, so since sort of the genesis of our Big Bang region, what's the average age of an observer in this ensemble of observers that exist at an equal time, then you find that the average age is tiny. In other words, almost all observers are really, really newly formed. And this is really strange also. And Max Tegmark recently wrote a paper where he showed really how strange this is. It's sort of not just strange, but more horribly ruled out than all science can be observed or theorized. And sort of the reason this problem comes up, especially the second one, is you're considering some particular time. So Guth's sort of toy model for this was, imagine that there's a universe that's dominoes. And the two-sided domino is supposed to represent an older, a bit of the universe that's a little bit older than the one-sided domino. And in each instance, you line up two young dominoes for every one old domino. And that's supposed to represent the genesis of new, young regions in the universe through inflation, because the line is exponentially expanding. And then he says, let's look at any particular time, then there are going to be twice as many young dominoes as old dominoes. And so the probability of being young, that is a one domino, is twice as big as the probability of being old. And so I said, well, that's crazy. You know, by construction, each two comes with a one. So the probability is half to be equal. And he said no, and I said yes, and this happened eternally, like inflation. So lonely and people can disagree. And it gets even worse if you consider that time slicing in general, which in the year of course are not necessarily horizontal. In these dominoes, you can pick various different time slicings. And if you pick the blue time slicing, then all the universes are young. If you pick the red time slicing, then the probabilities are equal. So it sort of is dependent on which particular time slicing out of all the choices you have to pick. And of course, in reality, it's much, much worse than dominoes, because each domino is an infinite universe, and there are almost infinite number of dominoes at each time, meaning that the number of dominoes or universes at each time grows exponentially with time. And they're infinite in many times, so there's sort of several levels of infinity that you have to think about on top of the fact that you can't even understand the dominoes. And people have worked, Linde and Maslumian and Malenkin have put a lot of effort in trying to remove this ambiguity, but I think it's safe to say that this is not really agreed upon or worked out how to calculate these probabilities. And my contention is that these, at least these string of issues, and perhaps part of the difficulty in calculating these probabilities, are connected with cosmological boundary conditions and sort of symmetries in cosmological boundary conditions. And these are very tough to talk about in semi-eternal inflation because the boundary conditions are sort of hidden in this initial cosmological singularity. And also because there's sort of an infinite amount of inflation between any observer and that cosmological singularity. So the connection is rather clear. And what I kind of think is that some of these funny features of semi-external inflation may go away, and boundary conditions be more understandable and more specified in inflation. If inflation, as well as being eternal into the future, also is eternal into the past, meaning that inflation, just like it goes on forever in the future, more or less in a steady state, also always has been going on in more or less the same way forever and didn't have any cosmological singularity from the beginning. And you can see how a scenario like this might work by analyzing what I discussed before, this double well case. We have a false vacuum and a true vacuum and tunneling from one to the other. Oops. And each one of these tunnelings creates an infinite open universe in the bubble inside. And if you're not familiar with this, it's really neat. I was sort of blown away the first time I saw an infinite universe being fit into a finite bubble. The way it works is you have this nucleation event. The walls of the bubble move out more or less at the speed of light, they're asymptotic at the speed of light, like that. Nestled inside them are these hyperboloids, which are slices of constant inflaton field. So these will translate into constant densities when inflation ends and the universe continues. So these are natural equal time surfaces, if you want to be equal time surfaces, like in a Big Bang model, to be homogeneous surfaces. But each one of these is an infinite open geometry, negatively curved FRW geometry. So inside, you have this infinite open universe sort of nestled inside this light. And you sort of traded some of the infinite time in this bubble going on forever for infinite space. So I thought that was pretty cool the first time I heard that. I still think it's neat. And these bubbles, as I discussed before, form at a constant rate, lambda, or per physical four bubble. So that each time, if I just slice through the universe, picking some time slicing, there'd be some distribution of inflated regions and bubbles of various different sizes. So how do we make this model go eternally into the past? The strategy would be to sort of make a real steady-state model by saying, well, semi-eternal inflation, that is future eternal inflation, approaches a steady state. We know that in the future, it sort of becomes asymptotically a steady state. So let's take the state that's approached by semi-eternal inflation and make it just the state of the universe at any given time. So for example, we know that in inflation, whatever we start with, the spatial sections get very flat. That's part of the reason inflation was invented to solve the flatness problem. So we'll start out with perfectly flat spatial sections for our state of the universe at any given time. Then let's consider bubbles between form between some initial time and some later time that we want to consider. So those bubbles from the side will look like this, from sort of along the slice will look like this, and then we can set that time to be earlier. So we're concerned about this time, we want to know the bubble distribution at this time. This is the earliest time in which we're considering bubbles to form. And then we just send this T0 to minus infinity. And what we can show is that although the bubbles take up just about all of the space, there is in fact an inflating sort of fractal skeleton left behind that increases in volume from each time step to the next and reproduces itself in the sense that the statistical description of the inflating and the bubble regions is the same at any given time. So the universe is steady state in the sense that the statistical properties are the same at any given time. It's time translation invariant. And like any theory describing a physical system, this has dynamics, which is stochastic bubble formation, and boundary conditions. And it turns out, I can't go into it in detail in this segment of the talk, but it turns out that these can be posed as the inflaton field is in a false vacuum on an infinite null surface. Other classical fields are at their minima on that null surface, and the Weyl curvature on that null surface is zero.
So you mean you adjust the lambda against H to get the same thing, so you can get your
Which part?
So how do you make that thing? So this picture you're drawing for arbitrary lambda and H?
Yeah.
Then you're
as long as lambda is small. So So what you need, if land is sufficiently small, then you can find a bubble distribution such that at the next moment that bubble distribution will be exactly the same.
It's all about here, not her way.
Yes.
Right.
And the Penrose diagram for this universe looks sort of like this. This is what would normally be a sort of double Penrose diagram for the super space. I kind of opened it up for these purposes, so it's helpful. Where the flat slicing of the super space covers this region, so each time would be a hyperboloid nestled into this light down here. And the bubbles form and expand this way, and these are bubbles that go to the Minkowski space. So the interior of the bubbles look like those little mini conformal diagrams. So this region is all inflating because of the bubbles, and they're infinitely many as you go to late times up here. A sort of interesting thing that happens from this is that given those boundary conditions on this infinite Bell surface that you want to make a steady state distribution, you actually end up finding that on the other side of that Bell surface there ought to be more bubbles for making another steady state distribution, another eternally inflating universe, but with the direction of time that points this way. So this is a strange feature of this model, but I think kind of an interesting one that the whole universe, this whole model, turns out to be time symmetric. So if I just flip this thing upside down, more or less, I get the same thing. So the whole universe is time symmetric, even though these two individual models, these two individual sides, both have an arrow of time pointing from the bubble formation to later on. So that would be the arrow of time of 0.09. So that's also a sort of complicated set of issues that I can't go into now, but that's one dimension. But the nice properties, I think, about this truly eternal inflation, first of all, there's no cosmological singularity. Everything is kind of specified at the level of physics that sort of, ideal. There's no big cosmological singularity where quantum gravity takes over and we don't know what to do. So we can really specify exactly what's happening and try to understand it. That may be bad news for people who want to test models of quantum gravity by using the cosmological singularity, but it's good for me, who doesn't like to think about quantum gravity that hard. Well, I do, but certainly don't understand it. But I can still talk about a whole cosmological model and see really what happens in all its detail. It's got simple boundary conditions that are based on a physical principle that the universe is the same at all times. So it's sort of an expansion of the classic cosmological principle of Einstein to what the sort of original steady state people, Feuerle and Bondi et al., called the perfect cosmological principle. The universe is the same, not just in all directions and all places, but at all times as well. And I think it sort of resolves some of these funny aspects of semi-eternal inflation, because the time since the Big Bang is infinite. There is no Big Bang. The time is infinite since this, there's no finite time since the Big Bang for any and all observers, and that's the same as the typical time. And there's a particular time slicing such that all times are exactly equal on the cosmological level. So the problem, remember, of these dominoes came about because basically there were twice as many dominoes, there were twice as many twos as ones at a given time. And that happened because the universe was expanding, so you created two new twos for each one to have four. And that's the problem in eternal inflation. You're creating, there's a meaningful sense in which the universe is getting bigger as a function of time. In this model, the universe is not getting bigger as a function of time. The universe at each time is exactly the same as it was at all other times. So there's no meaningful way to say the universe has gotten bigger. It's time translation there. So that sort of paradox technique goes away. And it leads me to think that maybe if we could, even if the universe wasn't really eternal like this, we might be able to calculate some things by assuming that the predictions in a semi-eternal universe ought to be the same as in a truly eternal universe, and kind of using what we can understand about the symmetries of an eternal universe to see what those predictions ought to be. So that's something I'm thinking about now. So I've said a lot, let me just sort of draw some conclusions about them. One is that if there's a multiverse, then there's an unavoidable, ambiguous, and important, all three things are bad, about how to make predictions in that model to compare to our observations. And this is something I call the conditionalization problem. We just don't know whether we want to just count universes or volumonics or baryons or galaxies or observers or what in order to compare to our observations. And what choice we make determines what predictions we'll get, both quantitatively and qualitatively. It's a mess. In the top-down or anthropic approaches to doing that, it would not be surprising to observe strange new coincidences in the cosmological parameters that we measure in the next 20 years or so, to find four different kinds of dark matter, three different kinds of dark energy, and more strange things that we would not expect a priori, just by normal, non-fine-tuning arguments. The anthropic factor, if you want to think about anthropic arguments, is not a delta function. It does not suffice to produce just one universe that's more or less like ours. We have to not actually know about a priori probabilities. We have to know whether universes with higher cosmological constants than ours are less likely or more likely, or how much more or less likely, because those will actually come into making the predictions for what we ought to see. It's not a delta function that makes all that information go away. And I call that the degeneracy problem, that we can play off these different cosmological parameters against each other to get other universes that are habitable like ours. I think it's still not clear how to compute probabilities in infinite ensembles of infinite things, times another infinity, I think. So this really needs to be thought about. The internal inflation happens even in principle, even in really simple models, calculate these probabilities, let alone in something sort of horribly complex like the landscape. I think we don't even know the basic problem. Finally, I think past internal inflation appears, as far as I can tell, to be possible. And it may aid in solving some probability issues and in clarifying the roles of cosmological boundary conditions for using these other things. Thanks.
You showed it started with a problem of the universe. It's not a legal material solution.